In the Voice of Russia World Service, we present the program Red Line.
Welcome to the Voice of Russia and its weekend program, The Red Line. Every weekend, we, Sergei Strokan, Mira Salganik, and Yekaterina Kudashkina, invite you to discuss the most significant events of the week. We are joined by Russian and international experts, politicians, scientists and artists, sharing or opposing our views on the vast and increasingly interdependent world shared by all of us.
We want our program to be personal, provocative and fair.
So this week, we will continue to follow the revolution in Libya, which comes as a crucial test for the world community as a whole. Then we will move on to discuss a story which claims that revolutions hold special attraction for Americans, and I wonder if that is really so. And finally, we will talk about Mikhail Gorbachev, the champion of glasnost and perestroika and of the evolutionary development as opposed to revolutions.
One could speak hours about the last topic in not only some 50 minutes that we have at our disposal, but I don't think it can be helped.
Okay, Mira, so then let's go straight to the point.
Precisely.
Beyond the headlines, this is Red Line's first heading, in which we'll look into, let's call it, Libyan puzzle. I think both of you, Sergei and Mira, agree that escalation of Libyan crisis comes as a major test not only for Libyans, who are caught in a civil war against their leader Muammar Gaddafi, but don't you think that this is also a crucial test for the world community and key international organizations whose major task is seen as handling international crises?
Well, I think that test is a key word here. And what I know for sure is that the situation in Libya requires consolidated international efforts. And not in indefinite future, but with no delay, as every day and hour matters. However, I noticed one thing, Katya and Mira. You know, while Obama administration and European Union leaders and Russia condemned violence and put pressure on Gaddafi regime to stop fighting his own people, there's no full understanding on what specifically should be done with this country.
Well, I think I'm afraid that the actions of the international bodies, not for the first time, demonstrate its inefficiency. That's my view.
Well, but the devil is in details.
But what is it that you would suggest the international community might do in this situation?
Well, probably you have noticed that the talk of the day is whether Obama administration would take a risk to go for what is called surgical military operation, like establishing a no-fly zone and bombing Gaddafi's air defense systems. So this is what is widely debated now.
Well, an option that could look like a quick remedy for the patient. Well, but don't you think it might be a risky venture, further aggravating the conflict and making it spread far beyond Libya's borders?
Mira, but this is what I'm saying, and the question is both yes and no. But at any rate, Libya in its present shape has every chance to develop into, I would call it, another dangerous global loophole.
But when you say a new dangerous global loophole, Sergei, well, I'm not sure I understand what you mean. So could you expand a little bit on that?
Well, Katya, this is not just a conceptual observation. First, the unrest in Libya could send a shockwave over the world oil market, further destabilizing crisis-hit global economy. And the price tag already estimated by some experts in some $200 billion. Second thing, till Gaddafi is in power, there's no guarantee that he would not use the stockpiles of chemical weapons, including 10 tons of mustard gas, against opposition forces in a last desperate move to stop the rebellion. And no one knows what would happen to those weapons once he steps down, presumably. And third thing is that the exodus of refugees from Libya creates a risk of humanitarian crisis in the region.
Sergei, I'm afraid you omitted to say what I think is very important. It is not at all clear whether Libya would survive at all as an independent sovereign state if civil war involving major region bases and tribes continues for a long time. And the other thing, whether Al-Qaeda and Islamists of other denominations, brands, would not capitalize on the situation to make this country into a new springboard for their ambitions.
Well,
that's the question.
Most observers say that there's been hardly any Islamist element in Libyan revolution as yet.
As yet.
As yet, that's right. But however, right now, at this moment, we can only guess. But the only thing that is clear, though, is that there is no chance for political survival left for Gaddafi, as he has already been largely written off both at home and abroad. And the main question now is, what becomes of Libya, like you say? There are a lot of former government supporters, monarchists and Islamists, among those who are now fighting against Gaddafi.
Against each other.
That's right. And I believe the last thing the world needs now is Libya being turned into another Afghanistan or Somalia.
Well, the question is still in the air as to what to do about it.
All in all, as I said before, the world community can't afford itself to simply step aside and passively watch the Libyan havoc. But again, my question is, what sort of action the world powers should take, if any? And would they be able to deliver, resisting the temptation to follow their own hidden agendas? Would they be able just not to fish in troubled waters, as it used to be till recently?
That's really a test.
But there's another thing just I want to emphasize here, you know. From my point of view, Libyan crisis has already become a sort of a watershed in world politics, indicating that Cold War mentality and approaches has largely gone into history. Russia's President Dmitry Medvedev's statement on Libya, denouncing killings of civil population and claiming those accountable for crimes should face international justice, was the strongest ever indication that Russia had departed from its previous carefully worded criticism. This is a very important thing, you know. And symbolically, last Sunday, all 15 UN Security Council members endorsed resolution, Mira, imposing tight sanctions on Muammar Gaddafi regime. And finally, I was really delighted this week to learn that high-placed Kremlin source, it was circulated by media here, called Gaddafi a living political corpse who has no place in the modern civilized world. This is something striking, you know?
Seems it really came as a difficult decision, Sergei.
Extremely difficult decision, especially taking into account decades-long friendship with Libyan leader, which is rooted, as you know, in Soviet times. I've checked archive photos of 85, and on those photos, confident Gaddafi strolling over streets of Moscow with Soviet Politburo members, including Andrei Gromyko, you know, so the Soviet foreign minister known...
Mr. Niet.
At the West, yes, as Mr. Niet. And the last time Gaddafi tent was installed in Kremlin was, you know, the year?
The 2009. Gosh.
When he visited Russia and he was entertained here. Okay. And Mireille Mathieu was singing to him in Kremlin Palace. This is something that was less than 2 years back. And now we have such a strong statement from Kremlin. This is something really.
Oh, but so do I get to try that while large-scale international intervention in Libya doesn't seem to be the best way to solve the crisis, closing Libya's airspace may be a solution, you say, provided it's approved by the UN Security Council, of course. Is that correct?
Of course, large-scale intervention, as I see it, that would be adventure.
I'll call it a disaster.
Disaster, yes, because Libyan people and Arab people would not tolerate that, and they would raise against that, and that would just play to the hands of Gaddafi and his followers. Well, some limited operations like sealing off Libyan airspace can be considered, and in fact it is already considered. But there's another thing, you know, we have to think over what would happen to Libya after Gaddafi steps down, and from my point of
That's
view...
That's
it! Yeah, from my point of view, after dust settles, what is probably needed is some sort of an international donor conference on Libya to work out comprehensive long-term development strategy, which would pave the way from authoritarian rule to democracy, something what we had at the conferences in Afghanistan or
Did
in
they
Iran.
Work? Did they work?
Well, they
no,
didn't
they
work,
didn't.
But that
no,
was a different
didn't.
Story. But I don't think that Libya would be able just to, in its present shape, to survive without international help.
You know what? You know what?
This is my point.
Now I suggest that we could ask all those questions to one of the leading American experts in Middle East policies, Elon Ben Mayer, Professor of International Relations and Middle East Studies at the New School and at the New York University. Dr. Ben Mayer, thank you very much for joining us. So please tell me, do you see the present situation in Libya as a civil war?
I think by definition, definitely you can call that a civil war. That is by definition when people from the same country fighting each other and in each represent different constituency. One group is representing civilian people, youth, and general population versus thugs. Sometimes elements of the military, sometimes mercenaries from the outside. So definitely, by definition, this would be a cold civil war. It has not reached the intensity that most civil war actually eventually end up with, but it is coming. I don't believe that is going to be subsiding anytime soon.
What are the parties in that war? Obviously, we know that one party is the government, but then the opposition, it doesn't seem to be a formed force as yet.
Well, if you actually look at what happened in Egypt, the revolutionaries there, they also did not have any specific, by definition, they did not have any leadership per se. And so they went out to the streets, to the Tahrir Square, and demanded change of government and demanded the removal of Mubarak. But when we looked very carefully to see what was in fact instigated that, was there any leadership, was there any outside people, outside powers involved? And there was none of that. So in popular uprising, it happens because there's the instinct, that is the population gets to a point where they get despairing, they are despondent, they've had it, and the success in Tunisia and the success in Egypt certainly gives a good reason for the Libyan people to conclude that a similar revolt, be that disorganized, will still succeed. I'm prepared to make a prediction for you that the Gaddafi's era is over. The question will be only when. It is going to take another week or two or a month or two, but he is going to be removed in one form or another.
That's right, but do you think that this process would require international effort?
Well, there is already international effort in place. That is, the United States taking certain measures, his assets being frozen, he's unable to export the kind of oil that Libya normally exports. Our military, the United States' naval forces, is getting into position. I'm not suggesting that military force will be necessarily be used, but when the United States prepares this type of forces, this will be enough to intimidate Gaddafi and the military to think twice about what they're going to do next. Having gone this far, the EU, as well as the United States, and the Arab League, mind you, has ousted Libya from the Arab League. When you have all of these three major entities, the Arab states, the United States, and the EU, Gaddafi doesn't have many choices left. You know, he's now going to Chavez and others talking about possibility of mediation by some African nations. This is, he's going to be playing for time, but his time is up. And it's going to be up sooner or later.
If we talk about the reaction of international community and the pressure it is exerting on Libya, on Libyan government, to be more precise, well, this pressure sometimes yields different results. In some cases, those on whom we put that pressure get more stubborn. Sometimes they yield, but sometimes not.
This is true. This is exactly why the United States and the EU do not and should not intervene directly if they can help it. Ideally, if there's going to be any military intervention, it should come from the Arab states themselves. And I don't rule that possibility out at all, because the Arab states themselves, each Arab country is going also through some level of turmoil. They also want to demonstrate that they are not going to accept another member state to willing to slaughter its people. This will serve the Arab long-term goal, the Arab current regime long-term goal, if they demonstrate solidarity against Gaddafi and do something about it. They are going to meet in about next 10 days or so in Baghdad, the Arab League. As I said, they already ousted Libya from the Arab League, and they will have to pass some kind of a tough resolution with some muscles in it, as I said, with some action against Libya. So from my perspective, Gaddafi has been boxed. He's been surrounded. He is no longer going to be able to really maneuver much, specifically also because half of his military has defected. Many of the missions around the globe, Libyan's missions, many of diplomats have defected. So he does not have any more the kind of diplomatic court on which to lean, nor the military prowess to use in an effective manner for a long period of time. That is why I think his time has come. Surely he's going to try to cling to power as long as he can, specifically his sons, who have even greater interest in staying in power. But there too, their days are numbered, and the sooner they find a refuge someplace, the better it's going to be for them.
Some analysts were telling me that there's a high risk of Islamist elements filling in the vacuum which will be created after the Gaddafi clan leaves the country or leaves power. So do you agree with that?
Well, I don't think that Libya is a good candidate to become an Islamic state, because when you look at the various constituencies that represent the public, Libya is a tribal society. There are many tribes, and the tribes hardly ever agree with one another or just about anything. So yes, there is an Islamic movement, but it is not entrenched enough and strong enough to be able to dominate. Moreover, If you look at the revolutionaries in the streets, they were not looking God is a great and waging that this resistance in the name of God. The resistance and the effort they're making and the plaques you see and the banners you see is basically directed against Gaddafi himself. And they did not use also outside powers to blame. They did not blame Israel or the United States or somebody else for their plight. They pointed the fingers at the government itself, exactly as the Egyptians did, as well as the Tunisians have done. And that is why I think, whereas there is an element of Islamists within the Libyan population, but they don't have the strength, for example, that the Muslim Brotherhood has in Egypt. So you can't really compare the two. So I feel that Libya is probably going to go through a period of extreme instability for a while before we can see some kind of government be formed. The role of the military remains to be questioned because the military itself now is divided. I might predict even a period of some kind of anarchy for a while before the opposition regroup and decide the kind of course they're going to take in order to stabilize the region. So we are in now for a period of intense instability. Many people will further die. He's going to try to cling to power as long as he can, but I think his days will be numbered. We're talking about weeks, maybe a month too, but not more than that.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Ben-Meir. And just to remind you, our guest speaker was Alan Ben-Meir, Professor of International Relations and Middle East Studies at the New York University.
This is the Voice of Russia.
Talking of revolutions, I have read a most extraordinary and emotional article about revolutions, which was published by the Newsweek magazine. And in fact, that's what I suggest we could talk about in our second chapter, Between the Lines, in which we always discuss one of the most notable stories of the week. So this one is entitled On American Revolutions and was written by Niall Ferguson, historian, political analyst, and former advisor to U.S. Senator John McCain during the 2008 U.S. presidential campaign. And the opening statement of this story might also sound controversial, well, if not provocative. It says, Americans love revolutions.
Of course, why shouldn't they love it, remembering how long ago their own revolution was?
That's
right. Well forgotten about it. Russia still remembers it, so it doesn't love revolutions.
That's right. But though I'm not through with it yet, you might find that the closing paragraph addresses your concern, Mira. He says, yes, Americans love revolutions, but they should stick to loving their own. Right.
I'd love them to their love.
Fair enough, Katya, but what's the essence?
Well, what Ferguson wanted to look into is why would Americans hail what he describes as the Arab revolutionary wave, provided that most rebellions end in carnage and tyranny.
Oh, Middle East revolutions again. Isn't that a little too much for a single program?
I understand, Mira, you feel overfed maybe, but I suppose it's worth talking about.
I mean, it exists.
So, coming back to Ferguson, what is his point?
Well, Sergei, the way I see it, his main point is that Americans tend to support revolutionary change regardless of what it might bring. So, just let me quote. He says, their own great nation, having been founded by a revolutionary declaration and forged by a revolutionary war, they instinctively side with revolutionaries in other lands, no matter how different the circumstances, no matter how disastrous the outcomes.
Are you sure they supported the Great October Socialist Revolution in Russia in 1917?
Well, I think we need to make a point here. I think it's not necessarily the U.S. government which we're talking about now. It's the Americans in general. So the October Revolution was definitely hailed by John Reed, the American journalist who traveled to Russia in 1917. He met Vladimir Lenin, and he was so fascinated by what he saw that he wrote a book entitled 10 Days That Shook the World.
I remember my school days, we were just learning English.
Oh, really?
That's right. That's right. But I wanted to ask you a question, and I'm being serious. I don't know, but I'd like to ask you, don't you think that the role of John Reed and his book has been grossly exaggerated by Moscow?
I'm sure you know the answer.
Is he quite so popular in the West? Because what comes to my memory is another book written later. It's called Darkness at Noon. Well, unfortunately, the Russian Revolution lasted much longer than 10 days that shook the world.
True. So there's another interesting issue for you. So are revolutions as brisk as they remain in our memory? So let's see. It has already become a cliché that what's generally seen as Egyptian revolution now, I mean the recent one, is now referred to as the 18-day revolution. So do you think it would be limited to the 18-day period?
Katya, if you ask me, I am not sure it was revolution. That still remains to be seen.
Well, anyway, but that's another point Ferguson is making, and that's really important. So here's another quote for you. So as you watch revolutions sweeping through the Arab world and potentially beyond, remember these three things about non-American revolutions. They take years to unfold. They begin by challenging an existing political order, but the more violence is needed to achieve that end, the more the initiative passes to men of violence.
Meaning?
Well, he is referring to Robespierre, Stalin, and Mao.
Oh, which means that the new names might be added to the list. Someone like Bin Laden or that Yemeni Islamic leader Al-Awlaki or someone else.
Well, how do we know? But the trend is there. Take Gaddafi, for instance. But let me go on. Ferguson also warns that, and I quote, because neighboring countries feel challenged by the revolution, internal violence is soon followed by external violence, either because the revolution is genuinely threatened by foreigners or because it suits the revolutionaries to blame an external threat for domestic problems.
Hey, and now it's Libya again, and that really echoes what Libyan leaders have been saying.
Well, yes.
But anyway, what is he driving at making this point?
Oh, it's something I'm sure you're all aware of. He says that the mere fact that the U.S. government initially hailed the protests as what they described as manifestation of the popular democratic sentiment, their craving for true democracy, so, in fact, came as another proof that President Obama and his team were caught by surprise and that they actually lacked what Ferguson describes as coherent Middle East strategy.
What does he say would that be?
Oh, well, as a former advisor to U.S. Senator John McCain during the 2008 presidential campaign, he's suggesting a twofold strategy. First, he says the U.S. should have tried to repeat the successes of the pre-1989 period when it practiced what it preached in Central and Eastern Europe by actively supporting those individuals and movements who aspired to replace the communist puppet regimes with democracies. And it was one of the reasons that when the crisis of the Soviet Empire came in 1989, there were genuine Democrats ready and waiting to step into the vacuums created by Mikhail Gorbachev's the so-called Sinatra Doctrine, whereby each Warsaw Pact country was allowed to do things its way. And the second part of a coherent strategy, according to Mr. Ferguson, should have been to exploit the divisions within the Islamist movements.
Well, as far as I know, no such effort has been made in the Arab world, and no one knows who is going to fill the vacuum which has been created.
We'll talk about Mikhail Gorbachev in our closing chapter, but now I'd like to ask my last question to sum up this part of the program. Well, now that we all know that the United States has no Middle East strategy, what then? Should we wait for the doomsday scenario Ferguson has described so successfully, or what?
Well, not exactly, Mira. The Obama administration is currently carving out a new U.S. strategy for the region, which it's going to present in the coming weeks. But otherwise, like Ferguson says, the Middle East revolutions could produce new enemies as formidable as Napoleon's France, Mao's China, or Stalin's Soviet Union. But look, I do get an impression that Mr. Ferguson perhaps tends to slightly exaggerate. So, now our guest speaker is Yuri Rogulov, director of Franklin Roosevelt Center of U.S. Studies at Moscow State University.
Mr. Rogulov, thank you very much for joining us. Do you agree that Americans love revolutions?
This is very questionable. Certainly, if we speak about American history, first of all, about American internal politics, the major tradition was moderate reform. It was probably the most radical approach which Americans could follow. And even under such circumstances, some of the reforms, let's say in 1930s, they still, the opponents of the reforms, call them as socialism or fascism or creeping socialism. It shows that any kind of radicalism has not been accepted in the United States. And certainly, speaking about American foreign policy in the 20th century, we can see that this tradition has been followed by the United States in the foreign policy as well.
I think that Mr. Ferguson, well, in his article we have just been discussing, maintains that Americans tend to welcome revolutions which are what he calls un-American, which occur outside of their country. Well, for instance, like they welcome the French Revolution, John Reed was fascinated by the October 1917 revolution in Russia, etc., etc., etc. But do you think that this is also the case?
Well, I don't think so. First of all, speaking about John Reed, he was one of a small group of Americans who applauded the revolution in 1917. In general, speaking about the American government and President Wilson did not support the Bolshevik Revolution and didn't recognize the new government in Soviet Russia. For many years, America has not been recognizing the new regime till 1933. It was more than a decade after the revolution when the Soviet Union has been recognized. Speaking about the French Revolution, of course, it was in the tradition of the American Revolution and American Constitution and Republican government. Certainly it was quite close to the tradition which took place in the United States at those times. But later on, we cannot say that the United States supported revolutions. Speaking about, again, the 20th century, if you would follow the events of the so-called national revolutions or movements in the third world countries, America has been opposing this, starting with the Civil War in Korea, and which led to the famous Korean War. Then it had been followed by Vietnam. It was also the question of the revolution and civil war in Vietnam. And many, many other countries, when the United States did not support this national revolutions movements in other countries. Speaking about the Ferguson article, which you has referred to, certainly if this article has been published, let's say 3 months ago, I would follow. I could agree with the author, but certainly all these events in Egypt and other countries had been a shock for Americans, and they were not predicted. And it was hard to speak about any kind of support for those movements because those movements did not exist in those countries. It happened suddenly, and it happened unexpectedly, and it was not a matter of strategy for American government. The strategy was quite the opposite. For instance, Mubarak's regime in Egypt was the close ally of the United States for many, many years. And this was the major strategy to support this regime.
To support this regime in its evolution, not revolution, is that correct?
Yes, in its evolution. And first of all, the importance of Egypt and the strategy itself in the Middle East of the United States was to help solve the problem of, speaking about the Middle East conflict, yes, Israeli-Palestinian conflict, is to persuade some countries, Arab countries, to support the peaceful movement, the peaceful decision of this problem. And as you remember, the United States was able to persuade Egypt to join the Camp David Agreement and to establish a relation with Israel. And that was the major strategy of the United States. So it is quite understandable why they supported Mubarak and his regime.
So it's interesting, if we start to discuss what's going on in the Middle East, it's interesting that the developments in Tunisia and Egypt, well, at least to my mind, they could hardly be described as revolution proper. But what we're witnessing in Libya now, well, isn't even a revolution, it's a civil war. So how do you think the situation is going to develop from now on? So as we have just witnessed, the developments are very uneven in that region.
Yes.
So
yes.
Yemen, I think it is balancing on the verge of revolution. But then Tunisia and Egypt, like we said, Bahrain, I don't think Bahrain is in such a serious condition. And the worst condition is Libya. So how do you see the situation is going to develop?
First of all, I'm not a specialist in the Middle East problems, but what I can see as a historian and as a politologist is that we are at the beginning of the serious change in many countries of the Middle East and North Africa. And what would be the changes? What would be the outcome? Whether this would be a real political revolution is just we cannot say right now. We even cannot say what will happen in Egypt. What kind of regime will emerge after all these events? What would be the role of the masses? We don't see the united opposition in these countries. We don't see any strong political leaders of these movements. And there are many, many other very serious questions. What are the slogans? What are the goals of this movement? We see the uprising.
We see the discontent, we see the division of these societies, and we see sharp conflicts. But what would be the outcome is just we still have to see.
But if this full-scale civil war breaks out in Libya, and if the international community intervenes, do you think that would somehow calm the situation in the region, or perhaps the opposite?
I believe that the reaction will be the opposite, because the situation is very complicated. We know that Libya is divided. There is a very strong tribal influence. And for the strangers to intervene in that kind of situation, you know, it will be very, very dangerous. It's like Afghanistan. It's like Iraq. We already have this experience for many years. I say we because the Soviet Union had this experience. The United States had this experience in those countries. Before the Soviet Union, Great Britain had very long experience of dealing with this problem. And we understand that under such a division, the conditions of division of the country and the tribal influence, it will be very hard for strangers to intervene.
So which means that, all in all, Mr. Ferguson seems to be right as he's saying that the region is in for decades and decades of unrest, of bloody wars, and of something we still don't know what's coming in.
Well, in this sense, yes. And in this sense, we can say that his appeal to work out a certain kind of strategy relates not only to the United States, but to the United Nations as a world center to deal with the conflicts. It relates to other countries in the region. It relates to Europe and European Union and Russia as well, and China and other big centers of power in the world, because they have to decide what to do, what kind of actions will be proper in this kind of situation, because the situation is very complicated. But I don't think that military intervention can help. It can help only in one case, from my point of view, if we would speak about any kind of catastrophe which could destroy the majority of the population or could bring diseases or any other catastrophe which can be the result of such a civil war. But the example of Africa shows that even in this situation it is very difficult to solve.
Isn't it that all revolutions actually bring along catastrophes?
I wouldn't say so, because we had revolutions of the democratic character which took place in such Western democracies as Great Britain, as the United States, as France, and as well Netherlands and other European countries. Those were revolutions which brought the major change of political order, which brought new standards, which brought a new system of law, and brought a system of human rights. That is why what is speaking about the Middle East situation and Arab countries, we don't see clear goals and slogans which could bring people together. And the situation is very, very unclear. We cannot say that the radical Muslims will not take the lead in these events. It is still very hard to say. It may happen. And we see disorganization of the civil order and civilian government, which may be very dangerous. But we also see that under circumstances like in Egypt, the army can play the role which can help to stabilize the situation. But in other countries, we see that the army is divided and can participate on both sides and even make the civil war even harder.
So, Mr. Ogadov, do I get you right that, summing up what we've been talking about now, is that you think that the situation is, one, extremely dangerous, that we still don't know how long it will go on and what it will bring, what results could it yield, but then the international intervention is still highly undesirable in this situation. Did I get you right?
Yes, you are correct. I would add to this only that from my point of view, what is very important is a matter of coordination of efforts of many other countries in the world and the United Nations. So this coordination and these joint actions may be needed very quickly. So it's not just intervention itself, but the coordination and the joint position of the world political powers on these matters, which may help not to intervene into these events, but to start negotiations, to start the dialogue between the different forces, and to help to solve the situation.
Right. Mr. Rogalev, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Just to remind you, this time our guest speaker was Yuri Rogalev, director of Franklin Roosevelt Center of U.S. Studies at Moscow State University.
This is the Voice of Russia.
So, Sergei, you heard the comment.
Well, Katya, to sum it up, there are different ways to deal with such threats like we see in the Middle East today. So, there are revolutions and there's evolution, an evolutionary way to be more precise. And in our next chapter, we are going to talk about the man who decided that evolution might turn the Soviet Union, which has generally perceived as an international threat, into democratic Russia.
Do I get it right that now we are turning to Red Lion's concluding heading, Man in the News?
We are coming to our concluding heading, yeah.
That's right. So this week, it is Mikhail Gorbachev, the last Soviet leader, who's celebrating his 80th birthday this week.
In fact, Katya, his birthday that falls on Wednesday followed a whole number of his other anniversaries. Let me name it. The 25th anniversary of his election as the Communist Party General Secretary. Then the 20th anniversary of his inauguration as the first and, as it later turned out, the last president of the Soviet Union. And finally, the 20th anniversary of his Nobel Peace Prize. All fell on 2010.
Look, Mikhail Gorbachev is a unique figure. Whatever one's assessment of his career might be, versed with absolute power over the Soviet Union, in that time undoubtedly one of the two superpowers of the world, Gorbachev launched a new policy of glasnost, which is for openness, and perestroika, which is for restructuring, in the Soviet Union that changed the global power balance. It led to the end of the Cold War with demolishing the Berlin Wall, its ominous visual symbol, and in the long run to disintegration of Gorbachev's own country in 1991.
However, since March 1985, when at the age of 54, he became the second youngest man to take over as the General Secretary of Soviet Communist Party, he is still admired by some and hated by others.
But you should add, Katya, that after his resignation, Mikhail Gorbachev has been keeping a low profile with rare public appearances in Russia. Though, as a speaker, obviously he is much in demand internationally. And Gorbachev Foundation in Moscow, which was founded in 1992, if I am not mistaken, is a kind of a think tank that is not much in the public eye here.
Look, it was François Mitterrand who I think gave the best description of Gorbachev's endeavor.
What was that?
I'll retell it, to his endeavor to reform the Soviet system. He pictured him as a man who just wanted to paint over an ugly stain on the wall. While doing it, he discovered that a brick under the stain is crumbling. He tried to remove it, to pull it out, and then the wall crumbled, and then the house crumbled.
And this is a difference from Yeltsin, who is supposed to be considered as a man who crashed the wall.
Well,
he didn't crash the wall. Don't let's go into this. Anyway, he sidelined Gorbachev very soon. So when now we are trying to sum up Gorbachev's, say, yes and no's, we ought to remember it.
Well, anyway, Vladimir Putin described the Soviet Union's breakup, as we all know, as the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. So there is no doubt that this is precisely how a large number of people in Russia feel.
But how much longer could the Soviet Union hold out given the enormity of problems, mainly caused by rigidity of its political structure and inefficiency of the heavily centralized command economy? So Gorbachev initiated change, but he believed not in revolutions, let me emphasize it, but in evolution. And the result, all of us know, the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Well, one could, in the same manner, ask another question, which is not a very valid one. Anyway, let me ask it. What would have happened, Sergei, what do you think, if Yeltsin did not sideline Gorbachev? How about that?
I don't want to restrict it to personalities, you know. I think that history has its own logic, you see.
Personalities do play a role.
To some extent.
Anyhow, you cannot blame Gorbachev for the collapse of the Soviet Union. He was opposing it to the very last. It is, I'd say, that he played a revolutionary role in international politics.
Revolutionary.
Revolutionary. Okay. I would like to stress it, revolutionary role. But domestically, he invariably acted as a reformist. Gorbachev did believe that the system could be reformed, but he miscalculated. Both the resistance of the system and the inertia of the masses kept inactivity for at least 3/4 of a century. That was what he miscalculated.
Well, Gorbachev is often blamed of inaction, of too many words, but let me just briefly say that during that time, words were deeds in itself. But well, it's interesting that today Gorbachev admits that he was too confident of himself, and speaking to the Independent this week, he even said that he was too self-confident, adding that he was punished for it by what has happened.
Well, others were punished too, you know, for some unknown reason, though. And I'm sure you remember empty shelves in food stores and long queues and old people who woke up one day in January 1991.
And the jokes that good talk no goods.
Yeah, that's right. But I'm sorry, just let me continue. So they woke up one day just to learn that they lost almost all of their savings to the money reform, right? And I'm sure you remember the notorious anti-alcoholic campaign. Okay, that actually amounted to elimination of precious vineyards, along with unprecedented increase in clandestine alcohol production. Well, that was so.
Well,
we all remember that.
Gorbachev mentioned it in his recent TV interview, and I personally didn't know the campaign has been planned long ago, before he came to the helm of power, and it appears that many in Politburo insisted on prohibition of alcohol during that
time. Good idea, no? Look, what I remember very vividly is that when I first heard Gorbachev proclaiming that perestroika means restructuring should start in the Communist Party and at the top level too, I just couldn't believe my ears. So many simple things looked outlandish to the people here. For instance, Gorbachev's appearance with his wife at official functions, with Mrs. Gorbachev looking so elegant and sure of herself. Whoever saw before the country's top official with his spouse in public, that was a novelty.
Well, theirs was obviously a happy marriage, and I'm sorry to say, but Mr. Gorbachev was really heartbroken when Mrs. Gorbachev died. So, and she died rather young too, was it in 1999?
Yes, Katya, and I remember her funeral, huge crowds, masses of flowers, and mind you, it was not paying homage to the First Lady. It was a sincere expression of sorrow for her and sympathy for Gorbachev.
Well, I think we have to agree on one thing at least. Gorbachev has opened this country. I don't mean for the rest of the world. He opened the country for us here by lifting the ban on our own history, our art and literature, hitherto absurdly censored by what meant under the name of communist ideology. I'm sure that the time will come when Russia will pay tribute to what Gorbachev has done for him.
And another thing is that Gorbachev calls himself a social democrat. He is a great believer in democracy, and he feels that development of democracy, implanting of democracy, is what Russia still has to be concerned with. Remember what he said about perspective of a revolutionary upsurge in Russia?
What did he say?
He said that he didn't think that Russia needs a revolution, but there's no doubt that society here should function in a different manner since there is a gap between social strata. There is not enough equity, Gorbachev said, adding, people must be motivated for better work that would give them more and more ability to stand to their interests. And he also said that the age of superpowers is over, so nowadays no nation should strive to achieve the status, neither Russia nor America.
Look, another striking feature is that while speaking about the Middle East, Gorbachev says that what is going on there is democratic revolution comparable to the fall of the Soviet totalitarianism.
Oh, Mira, by the way, I just wanted to ask you a question, but you were the one who met Mr. Gorbachev, didn't you?
I met him several times. Why?
Could you tell us a little bit about that? Could you tell us about your personal impressions?
Well, number one, I trusted him.
Okay.
I trusted the way he spoke. I know and I would agree that he was far too verbose, but that was his manner of speaking. He struck me always as a sincere man, and as I said before, I couldn't doubt him. Of course, I saw all the setbacks of his steps. I couldn't but see it.
But he is only human.
He is, of course, only human, but he is a man who, what should I put it in a rather grandiloquent way, he pursued a dream that he conceived. He hated the system that produced him because he knew it from inside.
Mm-hmm.
And that
That's
was
a good point. He hated the system which brought.
He said so in his recent interviews on Russian TV, how he hated the hypocrisy, how he hated the stagnation that couldn't have been broken. He pursued his dream. He is a tragic figure, and I'm quite sure the day will come when Russia would appreciate him for what he was and is. His present behavior is also highly dignified.
Could you recall your first meeting with him?
Yes, I can. There was a conference in Bishkek, in Kyrgyzstan, when he spoke, and that was the first time I saw him, and I was introduced, and we spoke some things like that.
What was it that struck you?
I told you, sincerity.
Sincerity?
Yes. Purposefulness. Those were the two things.
How many times did you meet him then, afterwards?
Look, 2-3 times, not more than that.
Did you manage to engage in a personal conversation with him?
Surely not, Kat.
Why not?
Because he was the president of the Soviet Union, and I was what I am now, a nobody. Anyway, no chance, anyhow, enough of that, of personal memories.
Okay, thank you very much, Mira.
Yes, but, you're welcome.
But now I suggest, you know what? The reason I was asking you, because I think that personal impressions are something which is very valuable in contacting people. But now we could also talk to Alexei Arbatov, because I know that he's a person who was working with Mr. Gorbachev.
Close to Gorbachev. Look, before you do that, on behalf of all the three of us, I would like to address Gorbachev and say, Dear Mikhail Sergeyevich, many happy returns.
And now we're moving to Alexei Arbatov, director of the Center for International Security Studies in Moscow. He has joined us to share his vision on Mr. Gorbachev and his time in power. Mr. Arbatov, thank you very much for joining us. Could you tell us a little bit about Mikhail Gorbachev and your experience of working with him?
I knew him since the very time when he came to Moscow and became first high party official and then eventually general secretary of the Communist Party and president of the USSR. But he didn't know me at that time. And I only personally met him already after he resigned and initiated his foundation. And then all of a sudden I had a call from him. Can't imagine, still it's a mystery to me how it happened, why it happened. But sometime around 1992, I had a call from him, and he personally talked to me and invited me to come to the foundation for a talk. And I came, and he proposed to me to join some projects dealing with international relations, factors of stability, instability, arms race, arms control, and provided the funding for this research. I was at that time working in the Academy of Sciences. And after that, for at least 2 or 3 years, we regularly met and wrote papers and discussed papers, and I personally got acquainted with this man. My first impression was not much different from the one I had knowing him, so to say, only as a very high political leader. He was very talkative, he was very simple, he was very forthcoming. He turned out to be quite a warm and sympathetic human being. But that's what I actually expected from watching him for many years before that.
But how did it feel working side by side with Mr. Gorbachev?
I had never worked with him when he was occupying very high state positions. Yeah. I only worked with him after he became a private citizen.
Okay, but anyway, as far as I understand, he's got some academic background.
I'm not sure he had some academic background, but he invited me as a member of the academic community and an expert on international security issues to participate in some projects of his foundation, in some research on international environment, risks and challenges, and so on.
But then, Mr. Arbatov, when there's so much time elapsed after Mr. Gorbachev left his position at the head of the country, how would you assess his impact on international situation when he was at the helm of the USSR?
It was huge. It was enormous. Very few people could compare to him by the degree to which they affected international relations. And what is even more, even fewer could compete with him in the positive effect they produced on international relations, because there were some people who had biggest effect, but in a very negative sense, like Stalin, for instance. Khrushchev had a very mixed impact. It was both good and bad, just like his domestic politics. Also, if you are interested in my personal opinion, the net balance of what Khrushchev did inside and outside the country eventually was good rather than bad. As for Gorbachev, his impact on international relations was comprehensively very positive.
In one of his recent interviews, I recall him saying that when he first met with President Reagan, Well, they spent the first day of their talks in an atmosphere of strong mutual distrust. But as an expert in international relations, could you recall how the international community started to accept Mr. Gorbachev and how the attitude was changing, or perhaps it was initially very favorable? Well, could you?
Yes, certainly. I was deeply involved in all that debate from the very beginning of his tenure in office as a general secretary. I would say that for the first couple of years, the majority of the Western public opinion and professional community and political elite, they didn't trust him. They did not believe that he was for real. They thought that everything he did was saying good words, making very benign declarations, but nothing would come out of it. But then when things started to change and when his practical foreign policy started to produce serious changes, that attitude also changed. And he very quickly became enormously popular in the West and in the world at large. In the West because of his ending the Cold War, in the world at large because of his ending the arms race and proclaiming the goal of nuclear-free world. So after a couple of years, he was accepted by the international community as a genuine leader of his country who could make things happen, who could produce real changes in foreign policy of one of the two nuclear superpowers.
But how would you assess Mr. Gorbachev's international role now? As far as I understand, he's a welcome lecturer in many international institutions, isn't he?
His international role now is not that of policymaker and not that of expert on international relations, but his international role is that of a moral leader, of recognized moral leader who has proved that things could change, that things could happen, and his role, in my assessment, is extremely positive.
But as far as I understand, he's traveling much to lecture around the world?
That's my understanding, too. I have not been seeing him very often recently. I've only watched his activities from aside. But I think he's traveling a lot. And I repeat that he is one of the, I would say, not just one of them, but I think the most respected and widely recognized moral authority in the world. And he has certainly gained recognition as a person who ended Cold War, who ended arms race, and liberated people of the Eastern Europe and gave them freedom and did away with the split of the world and of Europe into two hostile camps.
Well, Mr. Arbatov, thank you very much.
Well, and with this, I suppose we end this edition of Red Line brought to you by the Voice of Russia radio station. It was presented by its founders, Mira Salganik and Sergei Strokin, and me, Yekaterina Kudashkina. We were assisted by our editor, Vladimir Golovkin. So thank you very much for staying with us. Goodbye and take care.
Take care and goodbye.
So long.
Goodbye.
So long.
Goodbye.
So long.
Goodbye.